despicable food offerings, and in them I hear how the women in his family have loved him. Here, have peanuts and buffalo milk, he texts me. Have gâteau, black tea with fresh mint. Come eat pickled lemons from my hand. Have tomatoes with cumin. Are you happy? I am trying to please you with the little I have. Here, have grapes. Have a chocolate croissant.
Question. What if male arousal is only a gasp misplaced in the body? When we met again, it was at the tail end of a heat wave, during which the poor and elderly, those who couldn't afford or didn't believe in air conditioning, expired all over Cairo. I had 20 pounds in my pocket, so we sat at my ahwa under the bridge where they charged me humane prices. The American wore a sheer negligee, floor-length but essentially bedroom, with gold earrings that oozed off her lobes like honey and a martial expression on her face. I've never seen such long eyes or such primeval bones. She looked like she had walked right out of the museum, and I told her so. You are pharaonic. Every single eye at the ahwa was on us. A woman who exposes her hair in a city where most women cover their hair is already considered attractive, in the neutral sense of the word, meaning she will attract attention. But a woman who neither covers her hair nor exposes her hair because the hair itself is not there, a woman who, of her own volition, shows the skin of her brain to the public. The children of the bridge began to call one another until a small group of them had gathered, talking loudly about the man who was a princess and wasn't his a pretty dress and whether he would give them a pound. The beggar woman selling tissues and peanuts did not come near us, probably thinking she was diseased, a young thing with her head shaved. But the men... The men were so shocked their dicks stood up. They peeled up the silk of her negligee with their eyes. They parted her legs, cupped her scalp in their palms, and breathed steam out of their nostrils like horses. Every shisha hose was coiled translucent in their hands. They sucked and puffed in her direction. She began to tell me of her life as best she could. She told me her father fancied himself a dental prophet, and her mother was across the ocean exercising herself to death. They were going through a divorce. She was alone in this city, which explains some things. She was Egyptian enough to wax her arms, but American enough to shave her head. She was Egyptian enough to sit at the ahwa under the bridge, but American enough to think a silk nightie was appropriate wear at the ahwa under the bridge. She uncrossed her legs when she heard the idhan, but then kept them wide at the knees like a truck driver. When we got up to leave, the giggling children pushed forward their bravest, who shouted in his cheap four-tourist English, "How are you?" She smiled in her own wannabe Beledi Arabic, "Tamam ya akhuya," then handed over a 50-pound note for him and his friends. I cringed. They ran away before anyone could stop them. But I'm glad they did, and I wish she'd given them even more of her money. It was in moments like this that she reminded me of the Germans and Italians I used to sleep with, who were so predictable with their sympathies in the months after the revolution. We'd be approaching a barefoot child doing his homework on the sidewalk, and I just knew they would start fumbling with their purses. I just knew they would pull out an egregious sum, squat beside the kid, ask where his shoes were and his mother, take a picture of him without permission. They thought it made them look conscientious instead of guilty and voyeuristic. I always let these women empty their pockets without commenting, since there was something retributive about the exchange, a kind of tourist tax. And now with the American girl, I catch myself doing the same thing, just leaning back, watching the scene play out, not tempted to intervene at all.
Question. If you are competing to lose, what do you win if you win? He told me he was from a village, Shubrakhit. He told me a New Yorker and a Kyrene have more in common than a Kyrene and a man from Shubrakhit. But he would not tell me what the commonalities were. Instead, he asked if I had ever ridden a microbus, and I was forced to say no. What about a tuk-tuk? Another no. And then I remembered that when we stopped at the kiosk for cigarettes, he had bought singles. I looked and seemed to see him for the first time. The hems of his pants were frayed. Strings dangled from his vest like lines of saliva. Yet he wore a perky bow tie. He wore black leather sandals with socks, but one of the soles was loose, flapping like a bottom lip when he walked. I didn't know then. Every night before bed, he washes his feet and socks in the sink, wrings the blackness out of both, hangs the socks on the bathroom door handle to dry for the morning. Only pair he has. He washes his socks every night, but he has never brushed his teeth with toothpaste or shampooed his hair. Does not own deodorant. If he showed a little more ideology, he could be considered woke, some kind of minimalist and eco-freak. How to say consumerism in Arabic? How to say toxins, microplastics, mutagenics, fair trade, ethical sourcing? But the boy from Shubrakhit doesn't give a reason for not shampooing his hair, just says he doesn't like to. What's a hipster without intentionality? Old-fashioned and proud and poor. Also, Egyptian. More than anything, what binds people to one another here is the pointless struggle for quality of life. I'm learning, slowly, that having money and the option to leave frays any claim I have to this place. It turns out that to be clean in Egypt is just to be free of Egypt, to exercise the choice to stay or go elsewhere, which most of the population cannot do. The boy from Shubrakhit will die never having crossed a border. He is so tall that when we walk around downtown at night, his hair catches on the butcher's hooks, which are black-tipped, yanking, the blood beneath them never dry. He took me to get liver sandwiches from a cart on the street, but not the popular cart. The popular cart is a pound more expensive per sandwich, which is robbery, he said. We sat on the sidewalk to eat, and I knew he had chosen the ground because I had chosen the creme slip dress, which would catch the dust like a wet tongue. But I take the metro all the time, I said, remembering that I had ridden it once when I first arrived, and that it had cost as little as a pound, as little as 6 cents American. We test each other.
Question. Is a country boy trading country stories for city stories from a city girl getting ripped off? I was born and raised in Shubrakhit Beheira, a small farming village of mulberry trees and bicycles, kite wars, stacks of rice grass piled 3 stories high, 90 kilometers from Alexandria. It is known only for its Napoleonic relevance, as the site of the 1798 battle between the French army and the Mamluk cavalry, and for black magic. Apart from the rare pilgrim historian, the only visitors to Shubrakhit are Arabs, who come from as far as Yemen and Morocco. Depending on how much money they are willing to spend, one of 2 sheikhs in Shubrakhit will lift works off their loved ones or else rid them of jinn riders. My own cousin had a work on her from age 6 to age 8. When it was removed, she vomited a mango she had eaten 2 years earlier. The work may be hidden in a piece of food that is consumed, or in the womb of a tree, or in the belly of a fish in the Mediterranean. A Saudi woman once came to a sheikh in Shubrakhit crying, "I went all the way on foot from Riyadh to Mecca, and when I got to the Kaaba, I couldn't see it." To which the sheikh famously replied, "Woman, you put a work in the mouth of a corpse buried 20 kilometers from the nearest village. Of course, when you went to the Kaaba, you couldn't see it." In Shubrakhit, before the internet, our only contact with the larger world was through newspapers and television. As children, after watching Titanic at the village cinema, we built a boat from enormous blocks of styrofoam we had stolen from the only store that sold imported household appliances like kettles and washing machines. We tied them together with rope, also stolen, and floated the whole pathetic contraption in the Nile. After watching Mel Gibson revolt against the execution of his lover, we built forts out of stacks of rice grass, and inside them played war with slingshots or else fucked the poor girls from the other side of the river. In 2011, when I returned from Cairo for the first and only time, my father came to meet me out by the pigeon tower so he could enter the village with his arm around my shoulders. His son, the revolutionary with the city hair that stuck up on all sides like a sunflower. I stayed for 1 week, and that whole week, dizzied around the house that had never homed me, like a trapped moth. People from all over the village came to us for news of Cairo. And my father did not leave my side. So proud was his breathing.
Question: how far can you run from home before you have to face what your father has done? Why do I keep seeing him everywhere? My slim-faced, long-boned father with an accent in both his languages, with the papyrus framed on the wall of his waiting room and the oud charming his patients over the speaker system. My father, who went through the tedious legal work of reverting his name from Freddy to Fouad after realizing the marketability of the Orient in the Manhattan alternative health industry. In 2004, he suddenly became a fad. The first holistic dentist in New York, his business card exclaimed, along with other such desirables as oil pulling, bloodletting, authentic North African remedies for Western dental catastrophes, 9,000 years of medical experience. I resent him because I recognize him. This desperation to refashion ourselves into the most pleasing form makes fools of us both. We're pliable, capricious, shed our skin at the slightest threat, and ultimately stick out everywhere we go. We were both more convincing Egyptians in New York than we'd ever be on this side of the Atlantic. There, I had enough Arabic to flirt with the Halal guys and the Yemenis at my deli. At school, identity was simple, my name etched in hieroglyphics on a silver cartouche at my throat. I could say, back home, we do it like this, pat our bread flat and round, never having patted bread flat or otherwise. But here I keep saying I'm Egyptian and no one believes me. I'm the other kind of other, someone come from abroad who could just as easily return there. In Arabic, I keep using the wrong verb tenses or mixing up the feminine and the masculine, and they pick me out immediately. It helps to stay quiet. I keep nodding, pretending I understand, and then frantically Googling phrases late at night, but not everything is Googleable. I tried to tell a taxi driver I wanted to get off on the west side of Zamalek, and it was like he'd never heard of west. No one uses the cardinal points for directions. The Do'i side? He asked, and I wasn't sure, couldn't say. The maps are all wrong. Where the roads are numbered, rarely, they are not ordered consecutively, and when they are named, no one uses those names. The landmarks are arbitrary. A discontinued post office, a banana seller. The bridges are referred to by dates. I'll take the 26th of July to Zamalek, and then you point where you want to get off, the driver says politely. It's as though the city were deliberately designed to resist comprehension and to discipline those who left for daring to return. You have either lived here and you know, or you never have and never will.
Question: is a father who won't speak up for you the same as a father who can't speak at all? My father is a mute. He plays with rubber tires for a living and disappoints everyone around him. A mechanic. When I was 7, he tried to marry the neighbor's 15-year-old daughter, a girl so immature she used to throw clothespins at the frogs from her window when they were too loud at night. He did not succeed, but mother still left the house for 3 years in protest. Although he was mute, not deaf, my mother had long adopted gesture as her primary language. When upset with him, she might remove all the buttons from his good shirt, or offer only radishes for dinner. While they were in this stalemate about the potential second wife, I was deposited in the care of my grandmother, a dough-bodied woman who was infatuated by paper. She had learned from a book, before YouTube made it easy, how to fold paper the Japanese way, and had a whole room in her two-room house by the river for her collection of paper cranes and lotuses. When I came to her at the age of 7, she made space for me in her narrow bed, and that was how he lived. It was more generosity than I had ever known. We lived like royalty, eating when we wanted, whatever we wanted. I grew 4 inches in my first year, breakfasting on cake from flour she had ground herself, sleeping rarely, swimming often in moonlit rivers. We danced American in the room of cranes, my arm around her waist. Most people, when they learn where I am from, expect that I had a back-breaking childhood, that I grew up drinking a glass of steaming ghee every morning, swallowing garlic cloves whole, and heading out to plow the fields. The truth is, people everywhere need to do more than just eat. In Shubra Khit, there are lawyers and electricians, musicians, tailors, knife sharpeners, teachers, drivers, plumbers, doctors, carpenters, blacksmiths, architects, painters. There's a woman in Shubra Khit who makes buttons. There's a man who hand-paints signs and wedding invitations. My grandmother dreamed I would make films like Yusuf Shaheen, and that one day, they would be screened in the village cinema. When I turned 9, she sold her wedding gold to buy me my first camera and wove me a leather band with which to hang it around my neck. After 3 years of this pleasure, word reached my mother that I wanted to eat peas. My grandmother was on her way to the market to buy them. It was summer, and mother, who was not affected by 3 years of separation, was suddenly moved to illness because her son wanted to eat peas. She came back to the house my father still lived in and cooked so many pots of peas, she who used to count peas, she who still splits tangerines, that my father called a sheikh to dispossess her. And still, I would not go home.
Question. If a city is actively trying to kill you, should you take it personally? 4 days a week I Uber to the British Council in Aguza, where I spend all day conjugating verbs on a whiteboard, enunciating the names of colors and the months of the year as clearly as I can in English. None of the students want to be there. In the morning I teach teenagers, and in the evening adults, men in suits who try very hard to get my phone number. I am the only Egyptian teacher at the center, so I'm the only one who can recognize them outside of their broken English, the only one who can restore their manhood to its full height. After hours of struggling to pronounce foreign triple consonants, tripping repeatedly over words like February and present progressive, they can switch to Arabic when our class is done and have their egos instantly restored. They flirt with me and horse around with each other, competing for my benefit. I let them because it helps. Language acquisition is such humbling work. I tell my students as much when I first meet them and make it a point to speak some Arabic so they can hear my own clumsiness. Though I joined the center only 6 weeks ago, my classes are quickly becoming the most popular, and I am bombarded daily by students in the hall begging to be let in from the wait list. "Miss," they say in English, though some are old enough to have birthed me. Then they whisper conspiratorially in Arabic, "We both know the IELTS is a scam and no one here is qualified to teach, but I need to get at least a 5. Please, you can't squeeze me into your class." The other teachers dislike me. They sense I am fraternizing with the students against them. Sometimes we all go out for drinks after work, and then the dislike is palpable. They feel threatened. Only one or two of them, men obviously, make an effort to be nice to me. When I come home at the end of the day, I am filthy and exhausted, but amazingly filthy. Filthy in ways that seem magical, given the route I have taken since leaving the shower that same morning. There is dust caught in the hairs of my eyebrows and upper lip. It lines the inside of my bra. When I blow my nose at the sink, the mucus in the porcelain bowl is black. No matter how short I cut my nails, they acquire black sickle tips. I spend twice as much time bathing to feel clean for half as long. At the Ahwa under the bridge, I complain to the boy from Shubra Khit about the dust, and he smiles enigmatically, tells me a moth wing is in fact only dust petrified into a fine sheet. As a child, he used to collect them. He used to catch dragonflies, too, and leash them to a half-pound coin with hair he plucked from his mother's scalp. He used to shoot birds off the telephone wires at dawn and leave them on his mother's pillow inches from her cheek. He used to suck on his grandmother's breasts long after his mother weaned him off her own with the bitter cactus meat she rubbed on them. I am careful not to react to this information, but surely there was no milk, I say. There was no milk, he confirms, but it was a gesture of nurture. I say, and you remember this? You were old enough to remember? He says, how could I forget?
Question. If your first love does not live forever, how do you forgive yourself? Then when I turned 16, mother sold the house by the river that my grandmother and I were living in. No one in Shubrachit knows how she did it. The house was in my name. Grandmother put it in my name to keep it safe from my mother, who still found a way to sell it to an upholsterer, a piece of a dog's religion, this criminal known to lend his wife to his own brothers when he was drunk. She sold it and didn't tell us. One morning we were evicted, like whores by a line of sniggering policemen, my grandmother wailing in her flowered house galabeya, while they carried out our refrigerator, our bed, our table with the food still on it, while they stepped on her collection of paper cranes with their field boots. She had been married for only a year before her husband died. She was a proud and loyal wife, and afterward lived independently for 40 years, despite the family pressuring her to remarry. She lived with my grandfather's memory alone, and it was enough. Then, at age 58, she was forced to move in with her daughter, and the humiliation killed her long before the dinners could, long before the oven. She and I took the downstairs and shared a bed, as we had always done. But it was not the same. We ate bread and beans, no cake, and these weasel portions of fruit. My grandmother stopped dancing. She stopped folding paper the Japanese way. When she killed herself, I washed her body with my hands as she had washed mine for half my life. I remember her body as though it had been my own. She was almost boneless, her meat so soft, almost edible. Then the long, sagging breasts. Because of the burns, her skin was rippled like river water. Her mouth was empty, full of dark red holes, the remaining teeth having been pried out by someone, probably to sell to the dentist across the river. Boiled and de-rooted, they could have been planted as crowns in the mouths of other patients. After all these years, it's this thought keeping me up at night, keeping me as far as possible from home, that her molars could be shining still behind the lips of someone living. Her molars, her thin incisors like grains of basmati. When my grandmother crawled into the oven, when she, and lay there cooking without a sound. The rest of us sat at the table, father breathing, mother fanning an even number of arugula leaves on each of our plates. We almost started eating, but the smell caught us just in time. I was the one to find her. At the burial, I carried the plywood casket on my shoulders through the streets of Shubrachit, and within 6 months, had lost a third of my body weight.
Question. If the men make animal sounds in your direction, which of you should get the bone? I've been shitting liquid since I landed in Cairo 2 months ago, and no one can tell me why. When I complain to Sammy, he says without skipping a beat, "So stop eating dog meat off the street." I forgot I had told him about the liver sandwiches I get a few times a week with the boy from Shubrachit. "What do you expect?" he snaps. "Street food isn't clean." So I stop eating from the liver carts, but the diarrhea continues. Reem says it is probably the produce. "Are you peeling everything? You have to peel everything." So I become one of those people who peel even peaches and tomatoes. But it doesn't help. Bottled water. "Even if you're cooking with it, even if you're just boiling pasta or making tea," says Sherry over the phone. "The tap water is sewage, dear. Don't trust it." I cut out everything I can short of starving myself, but nothing is working. I'm losing weight, coughing up lead-colored phlegm, asking myself 10 times a day, why did I come here? My mother is sobbing in all her spinning classes halfway across the world, as my father, a holistic dentist, how to say this in Arabic, divorces her from our summer home in the Poconos. Meanwhile, in Cairo, I'm buying shawarma for a 3-legged dog sniffing in a garbage heap, all the men laughing at me. It's exhausting, the levels of dysfunction, the sheer effort it takes to complete even the simplest tasks. Crossing the street, buying fruit, changing the cylinder in the stove. Everything is more circuitous than it needs to be. To pay my internet bill every month, I have to go in person to a Vodafone outlet, where I am handed a number by a man who is hired to stand beside an automated machine and press the buttons, for customers who apparently can't press the buttons themselves. I wait for about 45 minutes until one of the employees is free, and I can pay by credit card. Often the machine is broken or the system is down. When will it be back up? Could be an hour, could be a day. Neither the Vodafone app nor the website allows me to pay remotely. Why even have a website? I ask. You can pay your bill over the phone, a clerk tells me. As it turns out, I cannot. And this is just the internet. There is an assault course for every other bill and errand. There is the garbage, there are the crowds. There is the harassment on the street, which excited me when I first arrived, my mind delighting in theorizing ahead of my body. The Egyptian catcall is a form of social engagement, an interpolation of womanhood, increasing the potentiality of every public space, so refreshing after Manhattan, where no one looked you in the eye. But now I'm completely worn out. Reem keeps trying to convince me to go to Dahab with her, to get out of the city for some sun and sea. But I doubt I'd survive the 7-hour drive. If Café Riche weren't a 5-minute walk from my apartment, I wouldn't make it even that far. Some days I leave the apartment with the intention of heading to Garden City for a film screening, or over the bridge to Zamalek, and I make it 2 blocks down the street before turning around and going straight home. Even when I wear the swaddling fabrics my mother packed for me, I can't blend in. I'm recognized as an outsider and keep getting asked by complete strangers where I'm from. To my answer, here, I'm smiled at magnanimously as in, of course you are.
Question. If your father once put his penis in your mother, how do you get even? News of pornographic films first reached the boys of Shubr Khit in 99. I was 11. 2 villages over, in a garage surrounded by fields of sugarcane, a sheet was hung on a wall, a projector was duct-taped to the ceiling, and the only light for miles around was its light. There was a front door, and at the back, near a man cooking mahalla baya, there was a hole covered with a plastic tarp for customers to escape through in case of a police raid. The plastic chairs were set in rows. The cook had the sharp, veined, wicked arms of a widower with 4 sons and no daughters. He made watery rice pudding and mahalla baya in tin bowls. 10 piastres a bowl, and this was expensive. At midnight, we all gathered at the pigeon tower. We were aged between 8 and 12, the older ones with coats over their pajamas, and the younger ones hopping from foot to foot without. We walked an hour along the bank, and the frogs of the bank punctuated our steps, jumping as high as our waists, belching ego. When the first boy cut into the field, the rest of us broke into a run. We skipped, and one of us began to sing. If we stop dreaming, we die. And another sang, come to me, boy. What's it to me, boy? Our pockets chinking with a month's saving and stealing. The entry fee was £2, given to the cook's youngest son, a hilarious buck-toothed boy with the hopeful name Al-Muhtadi Billah. When we filed in, we were ignored entirely. We sat on the floor at the front of the room with our necks snapped back like feeding chicks, mouths open, stunned. We didn't speak or swallow for 2 hours while women, tall white women, had things done to them by men and then by animals. They wore no clothes on their skin, had no fat on their muscle, so they seemed doubly naked. Even the breath was being smacked out of them. They were panting and whimpering, begging for it to stop. By the end of the screening, four of our boys were crying. We walked back to Shubr Chit, with the dawn just breaking behind the fields. When we entered the village, we found every father from every household waiting by the pigeon tower to drag us by the hair.
Question. What if female arousal is just the belief that you will not die at this man's hands? Every few days we meet, but always outdoors, on a street corner, or at an ahwa. He avoids interiors. There's an itchy what-nextness about him that is most acute in confined spaces, even those that are familiar, like Rish or the stationery shop on Sharif Street. He automatically ducks through any doorway he enters, expecting that his height will not have been anticipated. Then he folds his lankiness into the nearest chair and shifts around, waiting for a bell to ring so he can bolt out the door. One day I tried taking him to an exhibit of photography at the townhouse gallery, thinking he would like it. To get there, we walked down Mahmoud Basyuni, where I live, then turned onto Champollion. It was warm. We were holding hands. When a schoolgirl passed by us with an oiled braid down to her waist, he said abruptly, as if inspired, "Show me a picture of you with hair." I snapped, "Show me a picture of you without." And he laughed so hard we had to stop walking so he wouldn't trip on any of the mechanics' feet. These were strewn up and down Champollion, twitching as though their owners were being gently chewed by the vehicles they were under. I couldn't help but smile. This preoccupation of men in Cairo with my grooming made being outdoors as uncomfortable for me as being indoors was for him. But I knew he'd meant no harm. He couldn't understand what it was like in my body, on the street, without him. In New York, I used to shave my head in the bathroom mirror once a month. I tried to keep this up in Cairo with the electric razor I brought with me, the stupid device whining shrilly, since the voltage here is too high. But every month I noticed myself delaying the shave and then going a little higher on the clipper guard size so my hair got longer and longer. I was losing my nerve. I prefer the clean look of a number one, but increasingly it wasn't worth the commentary. When it was that short, strangers on the street were always calling out "Salamtik" because they thought I had cancer. A beggar once even refused my change, saying, "You need it more than I do." When my hair was a little longer, I got called other things. Whore boy, sissy boy, faggot, biscuit, bicycle rider. Even with my hair at its longest, I got misgendered if I was wearing pants. To avoid this, I made a point to wear my biggest earrings and dresses, a little lipstick when I went out, and always headphones to drown out the barrage. Only the boy from Shubr Chit didn't notice the subtle changes in my appearance. We had been talking for 2 months, and he seemed to only just realize when he saw the schoolgirl that I, too, must once have had hair long enough to braid. This is what he was like, what I liked about him. A transparency that seemed at times a failure of imagination, but at other times a form of respect. He didn't think too hard about where I had come from or where I was going, how different we were from each other. He just assumed a warmth of feeling. That I had left him on red for weeks was not personal, for example. That he had wanted to see my hair wasn't a rebuke for its lack. He was just curious, communicating a whim, nothing more. You could see right through to the bottom of him. When we got to townhouse, he hesitated before entering. There were many people standing outside smoking, dressed as they would be in Brooklyn or Berlin. From inside, we could hear jazz and the hum of a large crowd and conversation. I felt him straighten his camera around his neck, as though it might explain to whoever was in there why someone like him had come. The gallery was an enormous repurposed warehouse in a humble neighborhood full of tradesmen, and I thought this, of all places, would be comfortable for him. We walked in. The lights were bright. It was opening night, and there were garçons milling through the crowd with plates of hors d'oeuvres. He turned around and walked right back out of the gallery. I decided to take him home.
Question. If a girl freely admits she isn't a virgin, can you believe her about the price of milk? August. We were arguing about balconies. The American paid 200 times my rent and claimed it was worth it for the balconies. I'd never been alone with her indoors before. She said, "From all four of my balconies, you can see a canopy of bat-infested trees, and at sunset they all get to screaming." I said, "Show me." And she did, ashamed of her body. When I took off her brassiere, she covered her nipples. When I took off her underwear, she covered her cunt. When I took her hands off her cunt, she covered her eyes and stood there shaking her head like a little girl afraid of a ghost. I didn't believe her for a second. The more fucking a girl has done, the shyer she pretends to be. It is a rule. But I will extract their names from her in time. She has the slimmest calves I have ever seen. I know at least 10 men in America have circled them with their fingers and thumbs. She has the cleanest ears I've ever seen. I put my tongue in them. She has the deadliest sideburns. Men in Cairo don't have an appreciation for sideburns. It is a strictly country aesthetic to see them smudged against the ear, so close to the neck. We were naked in a soft light, and my hunger climbed. It shouted through my shivering, like a bitch being drowned in the river. I insisted because she wanted me to. She said no, but she meant yes. Wanted to be pushed over the lip of the glass, but did not want to be seen wanting it. The sudden coyness, so uncharacteristic, perhaps the only Egyptian thing about her. She said no. No, again, more faintly this time. And my hair caught in her eyelashes, clung to the wet sides of her lips. This hideous pleasure at a woman's softness after months of only roaches and needles. She touched me as though petting flowers, and I held her scalp in both hands. Yes. She meant yes. So I gently pushed us both over the lip. We fell into each other, heaving with dry sobs. Afterward, I asked her what she was thinking as she drifted off to sleep. She sighed dreamily with the whole of both lungs, like a woman in the arms of a man she loves. Then I swear I heard her say, "Pomegranate seeds."
Question. Can you be good together if you don't look good together? It was only when he came home with me that I realized I had never been alone with him before, and that there was something unnatural about doing it now. When we appeared at the entrance of my building, the doorman stopped what he was doing, clipping his toenails, one foot on the hood of a parked car, to look the boy from Shubrakhit up and down. I had never seen the doorman behave rudely toward anyone. His face was openly contemptuous. "That elevator only takes two people at a time," he said loudly. But not to me. There was a sign on the elevator door saying as much. "We're two people," I countered as I got in with the boy from Shubrakhit and slammed the skeletal metal door, trapping the doorman on the other side with both his feet now on the ground. We went up with a shudder, and the next time I came down in the elevator, I came down, thankfully, alone.
Question. Does furniture recognize, or does it make, a stranger in the house? So this is how she lives. The first night when I went up to see her balconies, I didn't see them. I couldn't see anything but her small face and shiver body. Only when she left the next day for work was I able to examine the place at leisure. Her apartment is in one of the older buildings in downtown Cairo. A corner unit on the 7th floor with high ceilings and classical trimmings on all the balustrades. But the inside is insane, furnished with what she refers to as pieces, kalims handwoven by Fayumi Bedouins, bookshelves that smell of wintered linseed oil, hardbacks in English and German, which when opened, reveal ribbons and leaves pressed into their hearts, an enormous steel water filter with a piece of coal inside it, an antique French canapé, orchids that she feeds with an eyedropper and hides in a room I am not allowed to smoke in, a stool with three red legs and a slab of unfinished concrete, a gurgling air purifier, a phonograph, a seamstress's bust draped in pearls. The tables and chairs are all arranged as though for a portrait, at their best angles, with haughty upturned chins and arched footsoles. She leaves the shutters open day and night to display them to the world. The only mess she allows herself is littering the floor with her clothes. The silk dress she wore a week ago is still a puddle in the corner of the bedroom. But otherwise, the space is intentional, sensorial. She tells me the apartment was rented furnished from a distant relative, an academic who lives most of the year in Berlin. But even if this is true, enough of it is her own. She belongs to this apartment as much as I don't. It reminds me of the places the foreigners used to stay in 2011, which were always equally perverse. You'd walk in and be confronted immediately with the feeling that all the furniture was living in denial of its geographic circumstance, that the human who had done the arrangements was afraid of the city outside her windows. But in the American girl's apartment, she is perfectly comfortable, and I am the one slinking around the rooms like a thief, unsure where to sit or what to do. She comes and goes to work. And I stay in this apartment that could be anywhere in the world if it weren't for the balconies and me in it.
Question: can home be passed from one body to the next, like a secret whispered in the ear? He tells me that in Shubrakhit they never call a woman by her name in the street, least of all a mother. He tells me it's no one's business outside the family. If I want to call out to my cousin, I use her husband's name. If I want to call out to my mother, I use my own name and she looks up. I asked him how he used to call out to his grandmother, and he says, I wouldn't need to call. I'd be by her side. Is this why he doesn't like it when I go out alone? I always assumed he was jealous, but could it be protectiveness instead? When we are on the street, he moves naturally between my body and the traffic. He plucks my purse off my outer shoulder and rehangs it on my inner shoulder, where motorcyclists whizzing past cannot snatch it. Around every corner he expects a criminal, but everything is always fine. We are wizards together, a bald woman and a long-haired man in fantastic dragon clothes. All we need is a leashed monkey and some sort of instrument. We walk the streets and everyone ogles us. If he disappears into a store for a minute, everyone is whistling, hollering, hissing. He tricked you, honey, and now he's wearing your hair. Is your cunt as clean? I could like that. He comes back out and hasn't heard any of this, but he's seething as though he had. Expects it somehow. Stomps his sandaled socks and walks like a tantrum. Later, he points out scenes from the revolution, as if proving his machismo to me, threading pearls around my neck. Azez, that was the Brotherhoods. Everyone bearded in there, Quran playing day and night. The kids wiped it out with Molotovs. Now look, no beards and they have music playing like a normal restaurant. This store sold gas masks, that one gunpowder. There is a woman on the third floor of that building who used to throw bottles of vinegar and bags of yeast to us from her balcony, both being antidotes to tear gas. Pepsi also works well. This is where Subhi heard a bullet with his ear. It went in the left and out the right. That is the apartment Al Jazeera used to film the square from. Aren't you lucky to be here with me? Who else could tell you these things? No one else will tell you these things. He was right. Who else could get me up to speed? After so many lifetimes of peaceful eating, a nation overturns the dinner table. There is the darling outrage, a newfound entitlement, hope, yes, hope, and then betrayal, disillusionment. that sheepishness afterward at having been caught believing. For every Egyptian of my generation, this will be the greatest political event of their lives. The drama they return to and repeat to their children and to their children's children to explain the world they are born into. I missed it entirely. Watched the revolution on television from the comfort of my home on the Upper West Side, a French bulldog on my lap. How convenient, then, when all is said and done, to arrive in the riskless aftermath, claiming, me too, I'm one of you. I'm too late returning, and he knows it. As long as we are outside on the streets in the city that he owns, he leverages his knowledge against me. When we come home, he is less powerful, less instructive. But why do I say home as though he lived here? Does he? He came up one night, slipped my dress over my head, and never left. We've been playing house for the last 2 weeks, except that I'm both father and mother, bringing home the meat and also cooking it while he waits for me with his cheek in his hand. Do I mind? It's nice to crash into his chest when he opens the front door. He hears the elevator and comes to meet me before I can finish turning the key in the lock. I used to shower and go out after work, to Rish or the bars in Zemelik, but now we stay in more and more. It's getting cooler. We run hot water over our bodies and he soaps the day off my skin, kisses the top of my scalp. We make love everywhere. I have more than enough food to share. We eat by the light of a Siwan salt lamp. He asked me once if there was a spare key and I said I would make him a copy, but I don't.
Question. If a fly rubs its hands delightedly all over your excrement, is it a compliment or an offense? She is nicest to me when feeling vulnerable herself. Occasionally, she returns from work with her eye makeup smudged, looking fraught, frayed at the edges. And then I can count on her to cry at the slightest permission. I love when she cries, how the coal streaks down like two braids on either side of her mouth. That genital mouth of hers. Then I can comfort her, make her laugh. I know just what to do. Other times she looks at me with an appetite that is romantic but wrong, curious, consumptive, anthropological, as though she were peering at a moth pinned to a corkboard, shivering, still very much alive, as though she were laying it on her warm tongue, letting it dissolve there. It's her American showing, rolling into my village in a military tank, tossing at my mother's feet 3/4 of an apple she has only peeled with her teeth. Then I get so wicked I make up things just for her. Fantastic things that it tickles me to imagine her repeating to her gullible friends on the phone, reporting live from the front like some kind of authority. I tell her my grandmother used to cut my hair once a month with a knife she had licked to sweeten the blade. I tell her my grandmother used to save the hair she had cut, tie it around a stone, and toss it into the Nile so birds would not build their nests with it. I tell her that if a bird builds a nest with even one of your hairs, you get a migraine. You can't just discard willy-nilly things that once belonged to you, even if you've outgrown them. You have to be careful. Some things, I say my grandmother used to say, are holy.
Question. If a man and a woman call lovemaking by different names, can they still? He tells me some things are holy. Hair trimmings, for example, the inheritance of orphans, the first cigarette after a fasting day, a widow's loyalty to her husband in the grave. He looked so serious I couldn't help but laugh. Why shouldn't a widow remarry and have some fun while she's still alive? He swore and stood up, knocking his plastic chair back onto the road. But he didn't leave. He just stood there and looked around as though he didn't know what came next, had forgotten his lines. Then he lit a cigarette, righted the chair, and sat down again. A man wants to know who will close his eyelids when he dies. He explained, though that was not my question. I snorted because I wanted to know what came next in the scene where he loses his temper and towers above me. So if his eyes are closed, she should close hers too? I goaded as he continued to smoke and didn't answer me. He is both childishly romantic and a hater of women. But even as I goaded him then, even as I remember the goading now, I grow tender about it, as though he were some snarling puppy I'd found run over in the road and assumed responsibility for. Yes, he could be misogynist, but he was also valiant and sentimental, poetic, young-hearted, a weirdo in his own way. Years after the pornographic screening in the garage, after he learned where his father hides the dirty VHS tapes, rolled in a blanket among the winter quilts, and how to watch and rewind them as though he had not watched or rewound them, his grandmother made him promise never to open a girl. That is, the taking of virginity, opening the way a sealed envelope is slit laterally with a butter knife. By then, the boy from Shubrakhit had opened a girl already. He was 12, she was 12, and all the cousins regularly squirted each other down with hoses in the field or played hide-and-seek with the lights off, a variation they called the dark room. It began innocently, a touch like any other, her fingers around his ankle, pulling him out from under the bed. But after the game was over, they continued to seek each other, find excuses to be alone together, in the fields or at home. They touched each other during the years and years of their schooling, under his mother's roof or hers, with no one suspecting. He opened her, and when she married the butcher's son from down the road, she pushed a string of raw goat meat inside her so her husband could open her again. Afterward, when she tried to keep coming to her cousin for sex, the boy from Shubrakhit threatened to light her hair on fire. No love between them. He was not even jealous of the husband, only could not stand to double dip. Now he walks touching the heads of street children, looking like a prophet, a flat-footed caveman. You can see the dream of water in his wet-lashed doe eyes, his brows, his hair so black it is closer to white than it is to brown, shoulder length, curling wetly, smelling of biscuits. The jaw of a man women want to please. He referred to what we did together either in his heartbreaking English as sekis, or else in formal Arabic as a bodily engagement, or else in slang as making one. He closes his eyes during. After, he loves to be the little spoon.
Question. If you're waiting for the other shoe to drop, have you not thrown it yourself? There is always a sense that this is a trial period. She loves me, but she isn't sure. I've been clean for 3 months now, but it hasn't gotten any easier to pretend I'm well. I keep snapping under the stress, flaring at her. Then she retreats outdoors, spends longer hours at work, avoids me for a few days as though recalibrating. At night while she sleeps, I lie awake and fight off fantasies of Megdi. Some days the only thing saving me from calling him and going down to score, ruining everything I've been suffering toward, is this apartment. I don't have a key, so when she leaves in the morning for work, I'm effectively trapped. If I took the elevator down, I'd be on the street. Would the doorman even let me back up? When she got home, would she let me in? I can't explain even to myself how I know what I know. That we must avoid at all costs enacting this question. Our relationship is fragile, sustained by habits we intuited from the beginning and now adhere to. I spend most of the day waiting for her to come home, the hissing, heaving Schindler elevator announcing her seconds before she steps onto the landing. She may be the one with a key in her hand, but it is me looking through the keyhole, me opening the door before she reaches it. She's never home without me. I'm never out without her. Every Friday, we take a walk on the Corniche, then breakfast somewhere so the cleaning lady can do the apartment without ever finding out a man lives there. If we run into the doorman, she reaches instinctively for my hand. We might go down to the Ahwa for a midnight coffee or to the butcher for some meat, but leaving together implies returning together. She doesn't invite me up, because she doesn't have to. There's no pause for deliberation, no real option presented. We just go up together automatically. We do what we have done a dozen times before, delaying hand in hand for as long as we can the decisive moment, when it is me on the other side of the door, asking to be let in.
Question. Can a building designed to humiliate ever stop humiliating? The boy from Shubrakhid's cannot boil water. He says he's had a rough life, and I'll give him that. He's been getting it in the neck for years. He showed me the mosque on Abdul Khalik Sarwat, where he slept when he had nowhere to go, and his body bears scars in places that should not have seen sharpness. So fine, it's been rough. But even so, the boy can't boil water or heat bread on the eye of the stove, leaves the milk out of the fridge, tries to cut an apple in the night, and I wake up to blood spattered on the kitchen floor, seeds everywhere. There's all the evidence of a past tended by a woman's hands. He's at least as spoiled as he is damaged, I mean. When I feed him an ear of bread with tahini and molasses, he takes it naturally between the teeth, kisses my fingertips one by one and then the knuckles. We sleep and make love and eat and make love and sleep. We live like a married couple dreaming domestic dreams until he wakes me up. One night I came home several hours late, having gotten drinks with some of the teachers at the British Council. He didn't say anything but followed me into the kitchen where he noticed, seemingly for the first time, the door leading to a hidden staircase beside the stove. He stared at it for 10 seconds before calmly lifting a glass and throwing it against the wall, demanding, "How can you live in a building that used to have a servant's staircase? Don't you know anything? Don't you have principles?" It was the first time I saw him get nasty, and I recognized immediately that it was not about me, not about the classist architecture of my building. Rather, it had all become too much somehow. I held his gaze and said nothing until he left the kitchen. Then I picked up the glass shards and swept carefully, thinking, he senses that his usefulness is depleting. Ever since he showed me how to buy vegetables from Bebelouk, I no longer need him to buy them with me, and I come home already laden with plastic bags. I've become familiar with the butcher he introduced me to, who keeps his meat in fridges instead of hanging outside to be smoked by car exhaust and wormed by flies. I've learned which pharmacists are actually licensed and where to buy bread that is fresh no matter what time of day or night you arrive. We no longer explore downtown Cairo together so he can point out to me his memories. 4 days a week I go to the British Council, and when I come home, he's there waiting, already at a boiling point. When he threw the glass against the wall, I didn't react. I puttered about making dinner while he watched YouTube videos in the next room and filled the apartment with clouds of smoke. He didn't offer to help, didn't even glance up as I trailed back and forth with pots and plates, glasses of orange juice I'd hand-squeezed that morning. I would never tolerate this dynamic in New York. But here, somehow it is harder to speak to. He is punishing me for something, and I am letting him. He is weaponizing all his losses against me, and I am wanting the abuse, or, at the very least, accepting it as mine. After years of claiming Arabness as an excuse for what I am, hairy, hard-boned, and dirt-skinned, sensual, impulsive, superstitious, nostalgic, full of body shame and estrangement, I feel I'm earning it at last. The hazing is belated but confusingly sweet. I have a guilt, and the boy from Shubrakhid's has an anger. In his sleep, he taps his pointer and middle fingers to his lips, dreaming of a cigarette. Sometimes he rubs the thumb side of his hand along his philtrum and sniffs. Tonight he made me a watch by biting gently down on the skin of my wrist and drawing numbers around the imprint of his teeth with a pen. It is a small apology, I know. It will be 3 o'clock all night. "I made you a watch," he says.
Question. Who does a nude belong to? The one who takes it or the one taken? Every few weeks she asks me why I don't do photography anymore, and I have to bite back my temper. If you have documented a revolution, how can you bring yourself to capture anything else on those same streets where your brothers stained the asphalt with their lives? I used to sell a single frame to the foreign news channels for £2,000 back when £2,000 was a filthy number. There were a few of us then, Sayyid, Khurshed, Mezo, and others. But after Morsi was dragged by the beard and we had to watch yet another dictator co-opt the movement, it became difficult to keep believing in photography as arsenal. It didn't matter that we were back in the square all over again, recording every moment with the same people that had come out 2 years earlier, the same tents and sandwiches. In fact, many of the photographs we prided ourselves on taking for posterity's sake, as archival testaments to the martyrs and believers, the heroes of our time, ended up being used against them. Since al-Sisi came into power, thousands of those who accidentally put him there disappeared overnight, many of them identified through our footage. There are more political prisoners in Toura prison today than passed through it in the last 4 decades. Men, all of them young, from poor backgrounds, who have no friends in high places to get them out, since we were their friends and look where we are now. Today, only those without a conscience are still working. Some photographers know how to sell their own. They play the grant game, funding from the Goethe Institute, scholarships from the Swedes, filters and hashtags, peddling themselves on Instagram. Or else they become common fixers, pimps, smearing our nudes all over the wet magazines overseas. I haven't raised my camera to street level in years, despite carrying its dead weight everywhere I go. I could show her my work from 2011 on CNN, but I don't. Her question is a capitalistic